Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 25th. The first order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Barr moves approval of the minutes dated January 24th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have two items on our agenda today. We're hearing the base budget oversight and program outcomes for both the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Excuse me, we have three items on the agenda. The base budget oversight and program outcomes for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, for the Department of Labor and Industry, and as well as the Office of Broadband Development. So, Commissioner Tingerthal, you're going to be up first with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And again, members, if you have questions, please get the attention of the committee administrator. I will try to defer those questions until the end of the commissioner's presentation, but if she needs to get a drink of water or something, then we can make a good time for a pause. Come on up. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony and presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and next to me is Katie Topinka, who is our legislative liaison. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. You should have a copy of our PowerPoint presentation in your materials, and today we'll be talking about our base budget and outcomes. We will not be presenting any change items today. Our mission, for those of you who are not familiar with us, is that because housing is a foundation for success, we collaborate with individuals, communities, and partners to create, preserve, and finance affordable housing. We are a little bit unusual for a state agency. We're an independent agency that was established by statute in 1971 and have been administering programs since about 1973. We have a board of directors, which is appointed by the governor to four-year overlapping terms. We have three members from the metropolitan area, three members from greater Minnesota, and the state auditor serves on our board of directors as an ex officio member. Because we are an independent agency that has the authority to actually issue bonds in the name of the Housing Finance Agency, we are independently audited by a major audit firm, and we are independently reviewed by Moody's and Standard & Poor's, and we have carried for a number of years a AA1, AA+ credit rating. So that is a standalone rating without relationship to the state's credit rating. No state appropriations are used to pay our agency operating costs. Our operating costs are paid through our earnings, largely from our loan portfolio. And state appropriations run about 7 to 10% of our overall agency operating program budget, not operating budget, but program budget. And I'll go through that in the next slide. So our sources of funds, about 56% of those are either proceeds from the sale of federally tax-exempt bonds or other mortgage capital. So because our single-family program, which is administered through lenders throughout the state, is our largest dollar program, especially in recent years when good opportunities have been available for homeownership, for first-time homebuyers, that is our largest source of capital. Our second largest source of capital is federal funds, and our breakdown on that is the majority, 87%, are for project-based Section 8 rent subsidies that come from HUD. These are for buildings that were built back in the 70s and 80s when the way the federal government actually did housing was to attach the subsidy on an ongoing basis for the tenants was attached to individual buildings, and it stays with the building rather than moving with the tenant. We also receive a small amount for rental assistance from the federal home programs and the low-income housing tax credit and the National Housing Trust Fund, and a little bit for rental assistance and asset management. The next largest source of funds is actually state appropriations in our last year at about 8%. We are able to use resources on our balance sheet to make amortizing loans. We call that our Pool 2 fund. And then we have a small amount of agency resources, which is essentially our, if we have any net income each year, we transfer typically that amount into what we call Pool 3, and we're able to supplement some of our programs with those dollars. So that's where the money comes from. Where it goes to, not surprisingly, is 45% to rental assistance. That's those Section 8 buildings I talked about, and that serves about 31,000 households each year. Our home buyer programs, almost 19,000 households, what we call non-capital resources, so that's, again, rental assistance that are funded with state dollars out of the State Housing Trust Fund. Rental production, about 5,000 units in 2016. Our home improvement lending program, and then our portfolio management and other other resources for a small number of people served. With regard to state appropriations for the 2016-17 budget year, the vast majority of those funds go to preventing and ending homelessness. The next category is development and redevelopment. That's both single-family and multifamily development and redevelopment activities. The preservation of federal rent assistance, so that's a program where we invest capital dollars into programs that have the rent assistance attached to the buildings. Homeownership assistance is a small slice, although we do use some of our earnings to fund that program as well. And resident and organizational support, we have a number of programs that we support through that. So our program delivery, we don't own or operate any housing at the Housing Finance Agency. We are a finance agency. The resources are generally provided to people throughout the state through a network of various delivery partners. So our single-family programs, whether they be single-family mortgages or home improvement loans, are actually originated through lenders. So if a borrower wants to participate in one of the programs, they can go to our website and see what lenders are offering our products throughout the state. So typically it'll be a mortgage lender that offers other lending products as well, but also participates with Minnesota Housing as a way to offer products to first-time home buyers. Developers and property managers are generally the ones that come in for our competitive resources for developing multifamily housing and a small amount for single-family housing. And then social service providers of various sorts, so organizations like community action agencies and housing authorities will contract with us to disperse the housing rental assistance payments and things like our family homelessness prevention program. Local entities, whether they be lenders or developers or social service providers, can access the money in a variety of ways. Are most typical, because we generally have more demand than we have funds available, is through requests for proposals, so we do it on a competitive basis, or ongoing funding in the case of our single-family mortgage programs. So shifting from the mechanics to our impact in 2016, and we will have a we produce a report each year that we deliver to our committees of jurisdiction, and that will be delivered in mid-February, our program assessment report. But these are the numbers from that report. Close to 69,000 households served in 2016, about 5,000 new rental units, a little over 4,000 first-time homebuyer mortgages, and 32%, that's a little typo on your handout to households of color. Just to give you a sense for who those home buyers are, those are households with an annual income a little over $52,000 a year. You can still afford to buy a house, a modest house with a $52,000 income in Minnesota, thank goodness. All told, all the resources that were available to people around Minnesota was a little over $1 billion last year. And of the competitive funds that we award, so those are the ones that we have more demand than we have supply, about 45% of those funds went to greater Minnesota, so outside the metro area.
I guess now seems like a good time to pause for a question. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Commissioner, could you explain a little bit more about your competitive funds? And it looks like I'm happy and think it's great that it's 45% of the competitive funds, but what does that really mean? Because if you've got only $100 million of your competitive, $100 million of the total resources are in competitive funds, that's a lot different. Because I would look at this and say that's, you know, $500 million is going to outside metro areas, and I doubt that that's the case. So could you explain a little bit more about your competitive funds and how much that is?
Commissioner.
Certainly. We have a number of competitive funds ranging from federal housing tax credits to our federal home dollars to our challenge funds, our preservation funds. So it varies from year to year. I don't happen to know the dollar amount that was competitive in the previous year. We certainly have that, can get that number to you. And I'm not trying to obscure the facts here, but oftentimes our single-family mortgages, there aren't as many in greater Minnesota, partly because there's been a significant amount of mortgage money available through the USDA, especially in the last couple of years. And because those are very low down payment loans for the USDA, they're essentially 100% financing. Many borrowers that are in qualified rural areas will borrow through the USDA rather than through our programs. So we felt that the thing that people are most concerned about is that greater Minnesota is getting a fair share of those competitive funds. And quite honestly, a few years ago, we weren't getting very strong applications from outside the metro area, so we've been spending a lot of time in greater Minnesota meeting with communities and helping them understand how to compete effectively for our programs.
Commissioner, please. Oh, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, two questions. The first one, I think, is the slide that's up right now, the 5,000 units of new affordable rental units. Are they new into the marketplace, units, like sort of plus 5,000 units? Is that how I read that?
Commissioner?
It's a combination of new units and preserved units. We updated the numbers with the tables we got today, and we don't have our printed report with us, but I can certainly get you the breakdown on that. But a fair number of those are new in that particular year.
Representative Baker?
Mr. Chair, what is a preserved unit? What's the definition of that?
This is when we have, as I mentioned, back in the 70s and 80s, HUD used to provide financing for housing where as long as the owner maintained the property under a Section 8 rental assistance contract, that those rental assistance payments from the federal government would continue to flow. If that building became a market rate building or if it deteriorated physically, those dollars could be lost for rental assistance. And in Minnesota, frankly, the Housing Finance Agency did a very good job of locating those properties really well throughout the state. There's barely a county seat that doesn't have one. And so it's really those properties where often there isn't enough cash flow from the properties to really do some of the long-term maintenance items. And so preserving those properties really means keeping them as good places for people to live.
Commissioner, please continue.
Thank you. The committee asked that committee asked for some information on how our employees were sort of allocated in the agency. So we have 110 employees in our multifamily division, and as you may recall from the sources and uses map, a big chunk of what we do is administer this rental assistance on behalf of HUD, so about 31,000 of the families actually receive that rental assistance, and we work with the owners and we do the income certifications and things like that, and we're actually paid on a fee basis for doing that work. 4,600 of that 35,700 families are actually families that are served by state-funded rental assistance programs. We also deliver shorter-term one-time assistance last year to about 6,600 families that where we provided relatively small grants, and again, these are done through groups like community action agencies, to families to prevent them from becoming homeless. We found that it's an extremely cost-effective program, and oftentimes it's someone facing a medical emergency or the loss maybe of one of several jobs in the family where they may be facing eviction or foreclosure, and helping them to get stabilized, maybe do a couple of months' rent so that they can get back on their feet is what that is used for. And then as we talked about, the 5,000 units that are either new construction or preserved. Then we move to our single-family division, which is our mortgage division. This, as I indicated, is sort of an indirect lending division by and large. So we participate with banks all over the state for those 4,000 first-time homebuyers. One of the things that we've really noticed in the last couple of years is that it's tougher for first-time homebuyers to they typically will have sustainable income to be able to support a mortgage, but more of them are needing help with down payment and closing costs. And for example, as little as a year ago, it would be typical for the seller of a single family home to pay a portion of the closing costs, to pay points, for example. In the past year, it's become such a seller's market among single family homes that it's almost unheard of for sellers to actually pay some of those closing costs. So we've seen more of our families needing to take advantage of a down payment assistance loan. We provide two different kinds of down payment and closing cost assistance for lower income households. They're provided in the form of a deferred loan, so they get the money up front. It's then recorded as a lien on the property, and then when that property is sold, we do recapture and recycle those dollars for a new set of homeowners. We also introduced a product that we're able to fund using resources from our balance sheet because it's an amortizing loan. We do have a type of down payment assistance loan that actually repays over 10 years, where the borrower can actually pay it right alongside the first mortgage and be able to get that equity into the property. So both of those have been very popular. The repayable loan, obviously, is for people with a little stronger incomes, but it's allowed us to provide that down payment assistance to many more people than we used to be able to provide. Student loans are certainly an issue for a lot of folks, and they just don't have that debt-to-income ratio to be able to qualify for a mortgage without some sort of down payment assistance. We also, again, through a network of social service providers, provided homebuyer counseling and foreclosure prevention counseling to almost 14,000 families all over the state of Minnesota. And that included, thankfully, a shrinking number, but 1,600 of those families were at risk of losing their homes to foreclosure. We have quite a strong track record with that program, really even from the days of the foreclosure crisis, with about 60% of, a little more than 60% of our families that get foreclosure prevention counseling actually do avoid foreclosure. And I think that's a good use of resources to keep that from happening. We also assisted a little over 1,000 families with our home improvement and rehabilitation loan programs. Many of those are senior and disabled households, often with very low incomes. So that's the variety of programs that we support. We do have, you know, a finance and accounting division and folks like that, but those are our programmatic staff. If you take a look at the next report, our agency is required by statute each year to provide to the chairs of the committees of jurisdiction a report on our operating costs as a percent of our total assistance that's provided. So you do receive a report in February of each year that gives you the top two lines of the chart that's on the next page. So you can see that in 2009, we hit kind of a low point coming out of the Great Recession of about 440 million in activity, and then gradually regaining our momentum up to about $1 billion in the past year. And our operating costs are then expressed as a percent of that assistance. And since the operating costs are not paid through appropriated dollars, they're all in a single category on our budget. They're paid through our earnings. So our FTEs that you can see have grown slowly, but have grown in concert with the increased volume of our programs. And we're able to be fairly responsive to things that when our activity goes up and down, and we have some places where we can make some changes relatively quickly when that happens. So for 2016, our operating budget was about 2.8% of the total assistance that was provided. If there are no questions on that, our housing continuum, just to give you an idea of the range of programs, our lowest income households that we serve are in our homelessness prevention programs, where the income of the households in those programs is a median of $9,000 a year. Supportive housing, which is kind of the next step. This is permanent rental housing where they don't have to move. It's not transitional housing, where they'll have access both to an affordable rent as well as services, $9,000 to $10,000 a year. Regular affordable rental housing, our typical incomes of people living in rental housing are from $9,000 to $22,000 per year, and affordable home ownership ranges from $32,000 to about $66,000 per year. Just to give you a sense, you know, certainly there are folks above and below those levels, but that's generally the range.
Looks like we have a question here. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have the number of persons served per category? And if you don't, could you get that to me?
Yes, we certainly can. That will be in our report. We can send that to you.
Any follow-up? Continue, Commissioner.
Thank you. The next page includes a list of our base budget programs, and you should all have a handout that goes through a brief description of each of the programs that's shown on this slide, and I'll go through those very briefly. These are the base budget items for programs that have been ongoing at the agency. The first category is our Economic Development and Housing Challenge Fund, which we tend to refer to in short as Challenge. This is a program that was created in cooperation with the legislature back in 1999. And this provides funds to projects all over the state with a focus on workforce housing. And it provides funds to developers for either multifamily rental or single-family developments, either new construction or rehabilitation. And it leverages federal tax credits, private resources, often from employers, local government funds, sometimes community development block grant funds that are awarded by deed, and it is our primary source of funding for workforce housing. I'll be talking shortly a little bit more about our workforce housing initiatives. Our housing trust fund is rental assistance for individuals and families who have experienced homelessness, and typical amount of time that people will receive rental assistance under this program is 3 or 4 years. Our Family Homelessness Prevention Program averages around $2,000 per household per, and it tends to be one time per household, and it can help with things like rental payments, assistance for the first or last month's rent, or one-time mortgage payments for people who are facing the loss of their homes because of foreclosure. The Bridges program is also a rental assistance program, and this is for families where at least one member of the adult household has a mental illness. And it's called Bridges because typically people that have experienced mental illness are eligible for certain federal types of subsidized housing, whether that be Section 8 or public housing. And typically waiting lists for those programs, depending on the jurisdiction, can run up to 5 years. And so the idea behind the Bridges program is that it will provide people with rental assistance until they're able to qualify for a more permanent rental assistance program for which they are eligible. These are typically people that are not really going to have a lot of opportunities for robust employment. They might have some employment but may not be able to generate a lot of earned income. So it tends to be a longer-term rental assistance program. Our preservation program, known as PARIF, it goes to the question from Representative Baker. This is our primary source to rehabilitate and stabilize federal rent assistance housing. A rental rehab program is used to preserve affordable rental housing that doesn't have subsidies attached to it. These are typically smaller properties, and this program is currently funded only in Greater Minnesota. The maximum loan amount is $300,000 per property, and it will typically be dealing with properties anywhere from one or two units up to probably about a 30-unit building. So at $300,000, that's about $10,000 per unit. We do certainly get a lot more requests for this program than we are able to fund, and this area, I would say, is a growing concern. Rehabilitation loans, this is our homeownership program that serves our lowest income households. This is for people typically living on a fixed income, a lot of elderly folks who are homeowners. A lot of these loans go into Greater Minnesota, and also people with disabilities. And this is for very basic repairs. The maximum dollar amount is $27,000. And typically we're doing the bigger ticket items like a new roof, a furnace. We're often asked to do a bathroom on the first floor for somebody who can no longer climb the steps in their house out in Greater Minnesota. But it does allow people to stay in their homes if that's their wish, and is administered largely by community action agencies around the state. That program has been continuously funded since 1973. It's actually the program that originally brought me to the Housing Finance Agency, and then I left and came back about 6 years ago. The Homeownership Assistance Fund is a small amount of state dollars that we add to our down payment assistance resources. Our homeownership education, counseling, and training fund is where we do we match that with federal resources for homebuyer counseling and foreclosure prevention counseling. And our capacity building fund, one of the primary uses for that fund is to help what are called continuums of care. These are regional organizations around the state that administer homeless program dollars from the federal government. Those dollars are available only on a competitive basis, and so we use some of the funds to help them write good competitive applications for those federal funds, and find that to be has had a very good return for us. So those are our budget, our base budget programs that you will see in the budget this year. And it's my understanding that the committee will hear any increases that are proposed in the governor's budget at a different meeting. I'd like to shift
back. Looks like we got a question here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question goes, if you could, on, I think it's on item 12 there on your on page 12, it talks about operating costs and the FTEs. Could you, are those FTEs broke down into these budget programs so that we know how many FTEs go to each program, or do the employees operate in all those programs?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Howe. The way they appear in the state budget is as a single line item, since no appropriated dollars are used to pay for those FTEs.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But do they operate in each kind of separately in each ones? I mean, I was just wondering if there's a if you could maybe in the future give us a show us how many folks actually work in each one of those program areas.
We really do budget by either our single family or multifamily division, and then we do cost allocation of the other support funds to those programmatic items.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Chair Grapple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, there's a lot of speculation and near consensus that interest rates are going to be rising in both the short to intermediate term. Can you just describe some of the opportunities and challenges that presents for your agency going forward?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, certainly each uptick in interest rates for single-family mortgages and also the increase in the cost of housing means that people on the lower end of our income spectrum will fall off the bottom of that eligibility. They simply won't have the enough income to meet the mortgage qualifications. We do underwrite all of our loans to standard secondary mortgage standards, and so, for example, we need to meet the overall debt-to-income ratios. So to the extent that that mortgage payment every month is higher, that means someone who is at the lower end of that income range probably won't qualify. So we're able to help out with down payment and closing costs to really reduce the amount of out-of-pocket that people need, and I don't see reducing our ability to do that. But I do see that we will lose some of those folks at the lower end of the income range.
Chair Garofalo. And Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, so these days, what is an acceptable DTI for people, debt-to-income ratio, for those who are applying for these loans, both on a, there's usually two numbers, there's the overall debt percentage, and then there's the percentage of their income that can be used for, that's viewed as acceptable for housing. These days, what are the generally accepted practices for your agency of what those two numbers are?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, there's less emphasis on what they used to call the front ratio, that is the mortgage to income ratio, and a lot of attention on the second ratio, which is the total debt to income ratio. And I say interestingly because with people having a lot of student debt and such, oftentimes that mortgage is more affordable than that overall debt picture. And that back ratio is typically about 41%.
And, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, a couple more quick questions. On slide 6, the FTEs, is this all FTEs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, yes.
Any follow-up?
Yes, Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner, what is the current, what is the outstanding loan portfolio right now, total assets that are outstanding?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, our total outstanding is about $3 billion.
Chair Garofalo?
Is that Canadian or U.S.? I'm just kidding. You have the best loans. Believe me, I know. I know the best loans. Everyone knows it. So it's my Trump impersonation for the day. Yeah. So last question. In terms of the number, is it just the two divisions that are under your agency?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, we do have a couple of other assignments that have a relatively small number of employees. We are currently serving as the host to the Interagency Council on Homelessness. They're housed in our office space, and there are two employees that are included in the FTEs for Minnesota Housing. And we also serve as host to the Olmsted Implementation Office for implementing the Olmsted Plan for people with disabilities. And that currently has three FTEs that are included within the Minnesota Housing numbers. Otherwise, the two programmatic areas of single-family and multifamily really contain all of our other programmatic items.
Sure. Chair Garofalo?
Thank you very much.
And we also have Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Garofalo brought up a good question about the debt to ratio, how that's working with you get the front end, and then you think you call it kind of a back, the second tier. This thing called the Affordable Care Act has really reshaped the kind of income people have. Now they're required by law to have a health care plan that many can't afford. In your loan processes and your applications, have you and the departments had to look at that requirement to pay out for family coverage if they're not covered by a business or if they're not covered under something? Is that a question you guys are concerned about at this point with household income and what's dispensable and those kind of things? I'm hearing rumblings that the banking industry is sort of asking those, they're having those questions, but maybe not on the applications. I'm just curious your reaction to how we as a society need to look at this now going forward.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, we have not really seen information coming out from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or FHA with regard to mandatory coverage items that are not included in, you know, from an employer under any of their guidelines at this point. I have to imagine that it's something that they're looking at within their underwriting standards, but it is not something that I think at this point has affected enough people that it has come out as a major change to underwriting standards.
Any follow-up? Go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you. Moving on to slide number 15, I want to just briefly talk about some of our results, not comprehensively for all of our programs, but first of all, homelessness prevention and supportive housing. Three homelessness programs serving about 1,400 households with rent assistance and 4,900 households with the shorter-term help. The median income there, about $10,000. And the thing that I want to emphasize the most is that we have had a very collaborative and effective multi-agency focus on homelessness in Minnesota, and homelessness in Minnesota has declined 13% since 2014. 2014 was the really the post-recession peak. There are many other places in the country where there are robust economies, where housing prices are going up, where homelessness is also going up. So we are successfully bucking the trend in Minnesota by seeing a decline in our homelessness. And I believe that that is directly related to the fact that this state has been willing to make investments in long-term supportive housing where people can live during that time when they're recovering from an episode of homelessness. It's been particularly key in the area of decreasing veterans' homelessness. The amount of veterans and chronic homeless, those are people that have been homeless repeatedly or have a disability, and that has reduced by more than 50% since 2010. Our number of homeless vets is now hovering just above 200, and we are still focusing the veterans registry on a veteran-by-veteran approach to ending veterans' homelessness. We had hoped to do that by the end of last year. We have a number of housing units that are going to come online this year that were financed with the bonding bill proceeds in 2014. We have completed two projects specifically for veterans, one adjacent to the Veterans Home in St. Cloud, the other adjacent to Fort Snelling in Minneapolis, and there are another 100 units immediately adjacent to the VA hospital site in Minneapolis that will be coming online this summer. Also, the new Dorothy Day Center Higher Ground in downtown St. Paul just opened its doors last week, and they have a large percentage of their permanent residents who are veterans. So we are keeping our fingers crossed that we can continue to really chop away at that number of veterans that are homeless until it is zero. Just to show you where we've been with the homeless count, we did reach our unfortunate high point in 2014 with about almost 8,400 people that were homeless, now down to 7,300, and we've had an even bigger decline, thankfully, among those who are parts of families with children. The next thing I'd like to talk about is workforce housing. As I mentioned, we have really had a program in the Challenge Fund to invest in workforce housing since 1999. But after conversations with this body, we have really put the pedal to the metal on workforce housing in greater Minnesota, and since 2013 have invested more than $30 million in this gap financing to finance more than 900 units of workforce housing in greater Minnesota. We work side-by-side with the Department of Economic Development with their funded program. And you should have a handout that talks about our combined numbers of where we've had some real success in funding workforce housing. We've funded housing in Thief River Falls and Roseau, Worthington, Jackson, St. Michael, Cambridge, Glenwood, Perham. Both programs, funded programs in Perham, Thief River Falls, and Roseau, Rochester, Austin, Owatonna, Mankato, Duluth, Hinckley, and Grand Marais and Lutzen just this past fall. So some of those projects are not yet under construction, but if you look on the back, we have given you some community profiles of Purim, 24 units in the Meadows Townhomes, which is an affordable housing development. You see the photo there. And the Grow Purim project, which started up a little bit later under the deed program, another 24 units fairly close by to the Meadows Townhomes. We also have worked with both the employers in Purim as well as the city of Purim to focus on providing down payment assistance to people wanting to buy single-family homes in Purim, and then just up the road in Frazee as well. We're also really pleased. I'm sorry. Okay. We're also very pleased. There was a recent article in the Worthington Globe about the progress that Worthington has made. I think many of you have been here a number of years, have heard from Worthington repeatedly about the housing shortage there. With JBS being quite a job magnet and having people running buses from Sioux Falls and other places, they really feel in this article that was published that they are really starting to make a dent in being able to provide rental housing for a range of people in Worthington. The Grand Terrace Apartments, you see a rendering there that is under construction, is affordable, and the Worthington Manor Apartments, which I think has not been started yet, will be done through the deed program, and we also continue our program of single-family development. There was also a small grant from the legislature to work with providing student housing in Worthington as well. So really kind of hitting it on all fronts in Worthington, and they're finally seeing some real improvements there.
All right. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I've got two questions. Does workforce housing all come out of the challenge grant, or do you have other sources that you use for workforce housing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, we bring a lot of resources to the table for workforce housing. The dollars that come out of the Challenge Fund are only the dollars that make up the gap that can't be covered with either equity or debt. Most of the workforce housing that's done through Minnesota Housing makes use of federal housing tax credits, which bring a great deal of equity to the table, and they typically will have a first mortgage that's provided either from Minnesota Housing or from another lender.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That brings up another question, but the other question I had at the top here is what percentage of the need are we meeting for workforce housing in greater Minnesota and in, well, VR1 Minnesota, both in metro area and greater Minnesota? What percentage of need are we meeting, and how much is left to get to a, you know, everybody's got a house over there. All workers have a roof over their head.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we estimate that there are about 600,000 households in Minnesota that pay more than 30% of their incomes for housing. So it's a question of, you know, if you're not homeless, then you do have a roof over your head, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you are living in a place that you can actually afford to make the rent payments. So that really, I would say, is the bigger issue. Is we're seeing some construction on the high end of the rental market, but we're continuing to see a great demand more in the middle or the lower end of the rental market, and that's really where we focus our efforts. And we typically, for our competitive resources, which Challenge is one of those funds, we typically see anywhere from 4 to 5 times as many good, valid proposals for those funds as we are able to fund every year. And the demand is really defined by the developer and the community they're living in. So we require an appraisal. We require a market study. So there's demand in communities that's documented by market studies. And so if we're seeing four or five times as many proposals, which are backed up by our market study, as we're able to fund, that tells me that there's still a lot of need out there.
Can you follow up?
Yes. So I'm looking at slide 17. You've invested $30 million since 2013. With your four to times the need, are you saying that you easily could have invested $150 million since in the last, what, I guess, four years?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I would say, yes, there are other proposals out there. And again, they are proposals that have valid investments, lenders, et cetera. They're not just somebody's dream that would have that would require more resources.
Representative Mahoney.
And this will be my final question, and it might be more complicated, or you may not even be able to answer it. I'm hearing out of the federal tax proposals that are starting to bubble up, I've heard a number of housing developers say that the housing tax credit and the changes they may make to that are going to make it even more difficult for developers to do these kind of housing, this kind of housing. Are you hearing the same thing, or am I being more smoke being fed to me?
Shortly, we need you to be done by 4, so if you can annotate your answers a little bit. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, it's a great question. The federal government has chosen for the last 30-plus years to put its dollars into affordable housing in the form of federal tax credits. The way they work is those federal tax credits can be claimed by investors for a period of 10 years in return for keeping the housing affordable for 30 years. The way the system actually works is that investors will pay money up front, put it into the property as equity, in return for getting those tax credits on their federal corporate taxes over a 10-year period of time. And so their rate of return on their investment really depends on a lot of factors, including what the corporate tax rate is going to be. And so what has happened is that with the House Ways and Means Committee in Washington talking seriously about tax reform and dropping the corporate tax rate, investors are now saying, well, the tax credits would have been worth more to me at a higher corporate tax rate than they are if we have a lower corporate tax rate. So essentially the amount they're willing to pay for those federal tax credits has fallen. And the way that it gets expressed in the marketplace, they talk about how many cents on the dollar they're willing to pay for those federal tax credits. And it has gone from paying a dollar for a dollar's worth of tax credits down to anywhere from probably 80 to 85 cents on the dollar because of that perceived change in corporate tax rates to come. So I would say that the market is facing some uncertainty at this point, but I would also say that there is very strong bipartisan support for continuing to fund affordable housing through tax credits at the federal level. So I'm hoping that it's a temporary blip and that the markets will adjust, but it will definitely cause us to strain a bit in this coming year for how we keep these projects moving forward.
I have a few more things to say, but I'll just skip it in the sense of time. But Mr. Trump is going to have – Mr. Garofalo's favorite president is going to add more to our headaches.
Representative Newberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thank you for being here. Just wanted to clarify, the title of this program is Workforce Development Housing, and the intent of this program is built into its title. So what I picture is you're building homes for workers to help with the economic development of these communities. So with that intent and with that title, is there a verification process? How do you know that the folks that are living in these homes are actually working in that community, or are they living in these homes and working in another community 40 miles away? So is that, as we move forward, and do you see where I'm getting with this? I just want to know that if we're calling this workforce development housing, how do you know that the workers are actually living there?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberger, you know, people make lots of different choices about where they live and where they work, and oftentimes it's an issue if you have two workers in a family, they may actually choose a place in between the place where both of them work. No, we don't have any kind of locational verification process, but I can tell you from having looked at the rent rolls of a lot of the projects, and it's typical that I would say 80 to 90% of the people who live in housing will work within probably a 20-mile radius of that. Some of these communities that are fairly close to each other, I can think, for example, along the North Star Corridor or the Highway 10 Corridor, you know, you may live in Elk River and work in Big Lake, but it's not fixed to that one community, and sometimes you have people living, in fact, in the small towns that surround one of the county seats and commuting from there. So it's pretty fluid out there, and people are finding the best way they can to find a place to live close to their work.
All right. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did just want to take credit for pointing out last session Chair Garofalo's admiration for President Trump on Twitter, so you can track it. It's still there.
Commissioner?
I don't think it is, actually.
If you can wrap it up in like 2.5 minutes, that'd be...
Mr. Chair, I have just really one slide left, and that is to recap for you our results on homeownership. Because we have really, really focused here, we have really increased the number of homeowners we serve in a given year by 68%, from 2,300 5 years ago to 3,900 in this past year. And we've increased homebuyers of color by 133%, and that's 32% of our total. That compares to the normal mortgage lending market of about 11%. So we really are focused. We're finding, particularly in greater Minnesota, a lot of the agricultural industry is attracting large immigrant families, and that oftentimes the best fit for them is to really see if there can be a way to buy a large single-family home. And we've seen a lot of that, particularly in southern and western Minnesota. And I also wanted to point out that things have gotten better for homeowners over that five-year period. 5 years ago, delinquencies, 60-day delinquency and higher, were running about 7%, and now they're down to less than 4%. So we do keep track of what the homeownership rates. Minnesota is still a high homeownership rate state at over 70%. And hopefully staying there. And finally, we just wanted to end on saying we work very hard to work with communities across the state to find out what their housing needs and help them to be competitive in applying for any competitive funds that come through our agency. All state appropriations that you'll be making decisions about go directly into programs and not for our operating costs. $100 million in state funds supports nearly $2 billion in total investment from all of our sources. And as I stated, there are over 600,000 families in Minnesota that pay more than 30% of their incomes for housing. So we know that results matter, and we try to get as much out of those state appropriations as we possibly can. So thank you very much.
We have one last member question. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Just a couple of things real quickly, and we can talk offline. We did some stuff in the Workforce Home Ownership Fund from last year's biennial budget. There was like $750,000 that we appropriated. I see some heads nodding there. I don't see that accounted for in the information that you have. And then I'm curious to know the 750 compared to the number of requests, and I see people are taking some notes here, and we can get this offline if you want. But then we also required you to come up with a process working with the stakeholders and so forth. I'm curious to know how that went, and then if you're going to be recommending any changes in that process for further improvements. And then in what you've listed here in your base budget programs, I would assume that reflects the governor's budget request. I don't see anything here that would mirror what we did in the previous biennium with regards to this particular program.
Mr. Chair, let me answer a couple of those questions. First of all, the funding, the $750,000 Workforce Home Ownership Program, that was funded with one-time dollars,
right.
So that does not show up in the base budget. Unless you choose to put that there. Secondly, the base budget that you see here is just the base budget. It does not include roughly $10 million that the governor included in his budget message yesterday. This is just the base budget. So we anticipate the opportunity to come back and talk to the committee about those requests and where those would be targeted. With regard to the Workforce Home Ownership Program, we have worked with the communities as instructed in the legislation. We have completed an initial round that they requested, where we did letters of interest because we knew that there would be quite dramatically more requests for resources than there were resources available. So we wanted to narrow it down to those things that were eligible in that program that were not at the time eligible in our challenge program. And so we have narrowed it down and have issued some invitations to submit full applications, and I believe those applications are due next month. So that's why we haven't accounted for it. The funding did not go out the door last year because of the fact that we were required to consult and put a different process in place.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, next we have the Department of Labor and Industry, so if you can come down.
Thank you all.
Well, everybody has printouts of this, so if we can't get it running, we'll survive. If you can introduce yourself for the record and go ahead when you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you very much for asking us here today. With me is Christy Swanson, our Chief Financial Officer of the agency, and also we may be calling on Jessica Luman, who's our Deputy Commissioner, is also here, but if need be, we're calling her up. Preparatory remarks before I get into our presentation.
Just one second. If you can speak closer to the mic, we can't really pick it up on the record.
A couple preparatory remarks before I get into the actual subject I want to talk about. First of all, our department is called the Department of Labor and Industry, and we take that very seriously. We have two numbers that Jessica Luminar's deputy and I were talking before today. There are two important numbers in our department that we think about all the time. The first is 2.9 million, that's the number of employees in the state, that are people are working in the state. The second number is 160,000, and that's the number of employees, or employers, excuse me. So we have to, we're the Department of Labor and Industry, and so we have to treat both of them fairly and decently and follow the law. And we do the best we can to be, I think at one point we say we'd be a trusted resource for everybody. We think that it's very important to us that we be trusted by both sides. We work very well with both sides of labor management as well as other stakeholders. The second remark I wanted to make is that we're going to be using a lot of, my presentation, as you can see in our handout, it's a lot of data sets. And we need these for measuring our performance, for measuring our finances. But they also, data also has a certain mind-numbing quality. I know that. You look at it, and you look at so many numbers, and you just start to go crazy. I want to point out that behind each one of those numbers are experiences, the workplace experiences of hundreds of thousands, millions of Minnesota's workers and employers that says something about their stories behind each one of those that are important to those individuals who are working, whether it's an injured worker, whether it's an employer who's seen his workers' compensation premiums go up or down, whether it's an electrician who's got his license on time or didn't get his license on time, or a newly graduated apprentice who has basically received the equivalent of a college education, has worked for 3 or 4 years to get his journey certificate, and now can look forward to a career that's going to be both fulfilling as well as economically successful. So those numbers these have meaning. I just want to point that out, that they do a mind-numbing quality, but we'll try to get beyond that. The first page we have is just our agency operating areas, and we have 422 workers that operate in our divisions are workers' compensation, occupational safety and health, labor standards, apprenticeship, construction codes and licensing, and general support. We have 422 workers, and about 300 are here in St. Paul, and the rest are in, we have 4 outside offices, and a number of people also work out of their homes. There are various inspectors and that sort of thing who work, cover various areas. The next page that we have is agency organizational chart, and this isn't particularly, I mean, for you guys, not going to be particularly interesting, except I want to use it to emphasize a couple things. First of all, that we try to be as lean as possible. We don't have, for example, we have an assistant commissioner opening that we've had for about 5.5 or 6 years. We haven't filled. We don't need it. So instead, Deputy Luman basically acts as assistant commissioner in charge of the construction codes and licensing, as well as trying to run, being the inside person for the department, trying to run the day-to-day activities there. Now, the OSHA unit reports directly to me, and so we don't have some in-between person there. So we try to be as lean as possible. We are allowed, you did ask us about communication staff. We've had 3 communications people on our staff since 2005, and we haven't increased that or decreased that. Before that, there were 2 people. And they basically handle stuff, all the internet stuff as well as press inquiries and that sort of thing. They keep pretty busy. And finally, we have 1 government relations staff person, and we've had one government relations person since sometime in the early 1980s. So we haven't changed that. Or 1800. That was around the time of the War of 1812, I believe. The next page is, this is where we more get into the meat of what I think that Chairman Garofalo is interested in, and just trying to compare and look at where the department's been. You'd see that the title is full-time equivalent employees. If you look down the bottom, the totals, in 2008 we had 442 employees, and now we have 421.7, basically 422 people. I'll quickly go through different divisions and talk about their sources of funding. The workers' compensation division is funded out of the workers' comp fund, which is funded by an assessment on both the premiums paid by people who are insured as well as the indemnities paid by self-insured. So we do an assessment every year, and that's, I'll go into more detail on that, but that's been going down, and it'll continue going down for the next 10 or 20 years, which I'll explain in a few minutes. The second one is OSHA compliance, and that's funded by half through the federal government and half through what we call the Assigned Risk Safety Fund, which is basically where penalties come out of workers' compensation, CCLD penalties are deposited in there. And so the trick is, whenever you do these things, whenever you have penalties, you don't want to set up a government agency that gets to eat its kill. So if they have any incentives to give higher penalties so they can make more money. And that's why you have limits on it. You say that you can't have quotas for state patrol officers or whatever else. So the way we do our penalties and our fines, they go into places where it will not benefit the division which is assessing the penalty. So there's no incentive. That's the idea. And anyway, OSHA compliance is, as you can see, it's gone down. Back to workers' comp, you can see it's gone down about 10 people in the last 10 years. OSHA compliance, which is the enforcement section, that's gone down about, 18 people. OSHA workplace safety and consultation is funded 90% by the federal government and 10% by the Assigned Risk Safety Fund, and that's gone up by 3. Labor standards is our only place that's funded through the general fund, and that's funded in part by the general fund, in part by the prevailing wage component of this, funded by the Assigned Risk Safety Fund. We added 2 people there last year, or 2 years ago, to the apprenticeship section. I'm sorry, that's even the apprenticeship section. We added these 2 people were added over the last 10 years because of child labor issues and the WESA program. The apprenticeship, we added 2 people last year. That's funded on the Workforce Development Fund. Construction codes and licensing, that's the division that does all the licensing for construction occupations in the state. Electricians, plumbers, boiler operators, pipe fitters, people like that. They also do the building codes and do plan reviews, which are reviews of the plans of public buildings. And as you can see, that's gone up from 127. That's funded out of its own fund, from the fees collected, license fees, and that sort of thing. And we will be coming in, as I told Chairman Garofalo about a week ago, we will be coming in asking for a $5 million cut in that fund, or reduction in fees, about $5.2 million. That's grown by 20, you can see. The reason for that is the construction. It's a lot more construction now than there was in 2008, you were just seeing the beginning of the downturn of the recession, and since then we've got a great construction economy, and or a very good one. I'm not sure it's great, but you'd call it a very good one. And so we just need more people. We've added more people. Same time, we will be able to cut our fees in doing it. And general support is what it says. That's the lawyers, the people like Christy to handle our the human resources and our finance people, and I guess myself and others. And there, you can see the numbers have dropped. So we assess the various divisions of the department to pay that. And also, the workers' comp has a direct appropriation. There's direct appropriation on workers' comp to fund that. And that's another reason why that's one of those don't eat your young reasons. We can explain that in more detail later. But you can see the numbers have gone down from 80.5 to 56.1. That's mostly because in 2014 we set up Minute, the IT unit, and so we just transferred about 20 people from our department to Minute, and so it looks better than we did. We didn't do anything particularly to cut down people. I love to brag that we've just been just drilling down. We did. There are a few fewer people, but for the most part, they're just transferred from Department of Labor and Industry to Minute. So you could probably get Minute's chart, and they'd say, well, we got 20-some from Labor and Industry at the same time. And that's true of every department that you're looking at. They all transferred some people to Minute at that time. And I think that covers that page. The source of funds that we have are, you can see the biggest single chunk is the workers' compensation assessment. That's 69%. And as you'll see on the next page, a lot of that, most of that goes out to benefits, both indemnity benefits and medical benefits. So I'll come back to that. 23% is construction codes and licensing. 5% is federal funds. Some of that is from OSHA, and some of it goes to cover, we collect data for the Bureau of Labor Standards, so we have like four or five people that are funded out of federal funds that just collect workplace data for the BLS. And we also have a couple grants right now. I think they run out in 2018 or 2019. That makes it a little higher. Contract recovery is 1%. That's basically almost a pass-through. What happens in Minnesota, residential home builders are not bonded. Instead, when they get a license, they add on $200 or $300 or $400 to their fee. I forget how much it is. And that goes in to cover home builders who don't perform properly. They forget to put in a kitchen. I don't know. Whatever they do. The porch caves in. But what you do then, if that happens to you, you build a house and the porch caves in. You sue them and you get a judgment, and then you come into our contract recovery fund, and you get up to $75,000 out of that fund to pay for your losses. And we'll be having a bill on that this year. Right now, a given contractor maybe goes bankrupt. We can only pay out $150,000 per contractor. We're going to try to increase that to $300,000 this year. And we're working with the builders. The builders are in favor of doing that. They're the ones that brought us to our attention. So we're going to try to do that. But that's not for today to talk about, but we'll bring that forth to you. Workforce development, or general fund, we get 1%. Workforce development, that covers our apprenticeship program and some other things. Any questions on that? Our budget. I think our budget last year is around, $257 million. And I'll go through that. You see the chart there. The $112 million is workers' comp benefits. Those are divided in three parts. There are two of them, it's called the Second Injury Fund and Supplemental Benefits. Both of them were done away with in the 1990s. However, the workers who are entitled to those benefits as of 1995 get to receive them. You can't get them. No one that was hurt after that can get them, but those who were entitled to them before that time still get them. And so at some point, 2040, 2050, those people all die off. But right now, they are getting them. And this... They expire. Those people expire. The benefits will expire. We also pay out about $20 million in a biennium for uninsured and bankrupt employers, people that simply don't have any coverage. And so we pay for
that. We do need you to be done by 4:30.
Great. We'll keep cooking. The rest of them, you can see the rest of them. Construction goes licensing, $56 million. Workers' Comp Administration, there's an issue. It says $33 million. We have we appropriated $10 million 2 years ago for computer modernization, and we have not been able to. We've only spent about a couple hundred thousand dollars on that, so we will be coming back to you just to extend that. But that's so that the Workers' Comp Administration rate around $23 million. And you can see that OSHA, Labor Standards, General Support, and Apprenticeship are also where their budget is. The next page, the most important page, I have this whole document. And that's workplace injuries, illnesses, and estimates in Minnesota. This is the best move in our department. You can see there in 1995, there were a total of 152,000 workers in Minnesota were hurt. 42,500 of those had days away from work. Go down to 2015, you'll see that number's been cut in half, from 152,000 to 75,000. Days away from work are more than cut in half, but to 20.4, and you all see the rates. The next columns, you'll see the rates per 100 FTEs. That's a great statistic. That means there's a lot less pain in families, for individuals, and communities. Those are people who are out working instead of being home suffering, or being at the doctor's office, or being in the hospital. Now, that comes from a couple things. I'd love to say that the Department of Labor and Industry is solely responsible, but that wouldn't be true. The first part is there's been change in technology, change in the way we work. There's probably less manufacturing. There is less manufacturing, and the manufacturing we have now is probably safer. So that's been a big change. I also think that employers and probably employees have become much more safety conscious than they were before, with a lot more safety committees, cooperative work on the jobs, that sort of thing. It's much more successful. I also think that enforcement, I think people are more accepting of workplace safety enforcement, of OSHA, than they used to be. And they understand the need for it, and so they've reduced their injuries. I think it's a great statistic, and it does explain one reason why we have few people work in our workers' comp division and why we have fewer people in our OSHA division, but also explains the reason for having those things. They're working very well.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Peterson, I don't want you to try to explain it now, but could you pass along to me or to the committee a breakdown by industry, the number of injuries?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, yes, we'll get it to you. We have certain target industries, and we'll also, as I will pass along, construction has always been a high one. The I don't know how much you want to get into detail, the rest of stuff. In the Workers' Compensation Division, just I want to point out there, it's not on the sheet we have. We have 32,000 first reports of injuries. You'll see it. Well, that's on the sheet, but by the numbers. Those are ones that are out for more than 3 days. 32,000 people, but right now, are out of work for more than 3 days. So then you supply, the employer is supposed to insure, will submit what they would call a FROI, a first report of injury. So that gives you some sense of where it is. But what's not on there is that the reduction in average pure premium rate since 2005 has been around 15.3%. So people are paying less for the workers' compensation insurance. For those of you who are employers or have been employers or have to worry about insurance costs, for the most part, your insurance costs should be a lot less in Minnesota than they were before, and we should be very happy about that. The Workers' Compensation Division has does lots of different stuff. Basically, administers a work comp system for Minnesota. The next item we have is the Workers' Compensation Fund. That provides, I guess I've already discussed it, but also provides for administration of the OSHA programs, administration of programs at the Department of Labor and Industry, and Office of Administrative Hearings, the Workers' Comp Board of Appeals, and $750,000 a year go to the Department of Commerce for fraud. OSHA compliance is, right now we have 66 FTEs, and about a operating budget of 16.8 for the biennium, 8.4. They do a good job. We're helping employees with compliance with safety, health regulations, on-site inspections, issuing citizens for non-compliance. We've got really good people. They love the work. They're very passionate about it. I also think they're very practical people that work on this stuff. We've got pretty experienced. We have a combination of experienced people and new people who then may work for us for a few years and go out and preach the safety gospel. Workplace safety consultation is the next item. That's the one item we've added people there. But the idea there is if you have a business and you need some help, you call them up. And they go out to you. There's a wall between them and OSHA compliance. They'll go out to your site and tell you where your safety problems are, what you can do. And they don't tell compliance about it, but just tell you how you can improve it, how you can maintain a safe workplace. And that's the idea of a kind of safety consultation, and that's I encourage you all to tell people about that. It's a great thing. They also administer safety grants, which is a great secret that we got over $1 million a year in safety grants. For you get up to $10,000 in a matching grant. Say you're a nursing home, you need some equipment to help lift patients. It's going to cost you $20,000. You pay $10,000, and then we pay $10,000. And it's a great deal. And we have cities apply for it, medical facilities, employers. We have one employer that applies every year and always manages to get away with. We've got to tell him some years he just can't keep applying, but he manages to get away with $5,000 to $10,000 every year. And he's made it work out very well. Construction codes and licensing. The next item, CCLD. There's where we'll be seeking, I'll repeat again, I'd love to talk about this. We'll be seeking more than $5 million in fee cuts from you. And that's an area we've seen a lot of growth. We had 151,000 inspections, or 151,000 home permits issued in 2010. Last year we had, back up again, inspections of all kinds. 151,000 inspections in 2010. Last year, 177,000 inspections. That means new homes being inspected, new pipe fitters, new boiler facilities, new elevators, that sort of thing. There's been a lot of growth in construction, and their workers have done a good job, and they've kept moving up. Let's see. I'm not sure I need to talk much more about any other items. They're all pretty clear. We've got 4 minutes, I see, that I want to just remind that apprenticeship is one of the great secrets of Minnesota, that a great deal, a great way to make a good living. Pipeline project is something we'll be coming to you asking for more money. And we think it's an employer-centered, employer-based program that we've worked with hundreds of employers to set up competencies in their fields for their workers, and we think it's a good thing, and we hope you can support it. And then
from Representative Metza.
Yes, or he'll defer to Chair Roth.
Or he'll defer to Chair Commissioner Finish, maybe. They can do that. So.
Or you can finish. There we go.
Finish?
Yes.
I was going to say, we have General Support, then we have the Office of Combative Sports, which is the favorite of many of you, and I could spend hours regaling you all with tales of fighting, of boxing cards and MMA, mixed martial arts. But I don't think it's a very small part of our department, but it's also some are fun than some things. It's pretty self-supporting. There's not as much boxes as it used to be. There's still a lot of mixed martial arts, and we basically license the people, ensure their safety, and make sure that people get paid, the combatants get paid.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and sounds like there's a lot of great things, and I'll look forward to voting on a good proposal later on. So.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, would you just take 1 minute to go over on page 7? The two columns on the far right here, under the rates per 100 FTE workers, could you just take a minute and just touch on those?
The
Commissioner.
Representative, Mr. Chairman. You can see in 19, that's, so 1995, you can see that means eight workers out of every 100, 8.4 workers out of every 100 were hurt on the job that year.
All right.
And the days away from work, that means that 2 out of every 100 had days away from work. So a lot of those injuries, you got cut, you went to the emergency room, you got taken care of, you went back to work. But then about 25% of them, you'd take off. It hurts your back, that sort of thing. And you see the same ratio, but it's dropped considerably from 8.4 to 3.5. And one of the interesting things is that these numbers have dropped, but the cost per claim, this may be more than you ever wanted to know, but the cost per workers' comp claim has gone up per claim, and that's because of medical costs. So we spend, as Representative Mahoney knows, is on the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out ways of reducing medical costs. We're trying to get a bill in this year to help reduce it by more, but we're having a little trouble right now. But that's what that is, 8.4. And we're very happy to see the reductions. should see fewer people going to the doctor, stay at home.
Thank you.
Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I want to thank you again, as I did last session, for coming forward with the licensing fee reductions to keep more money in the hands of builders and keeping those permit fees low. So I just want to say thank you for that. My one question is regarding the assigned risk plan. Do you have an estimate of how big the surplus in that will be? And if not...
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Garofalo, the assigned risk, there are two different things. There are two different assigned risk plans. There's one that does insurance. This is not it. This is just, I'm not sure why we use the term assigned risk. This is an internal fund at the Department of Labor and Industry. The assigned risk insurance plan is what goes out to people who can't get out of coverage. And so you go there. And that's, the Department of Commerce regulates that, and they have the information on that. It sometimes they have some surplus, sometimes they don't.
Jerry Garofalo?
I'm good, thanks.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner, you've been commissioner for 6 years or thereabouts. You really, really smart people at your office. You've been asked that same question about the assigned risk program at the department at DALI. Why in 6 years have you not changed the name?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, to fill up time. No, I don't know. We have to, we'll take a look at it.
Any more questions before they head out? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, the assigned risk program, where do the funds flow in there? Where do they go? What are they used for?
They use for I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Powell. They're used for safety grants. To get out the safety grants that I discussed a moment ago, and they use to pay for the workplace safety consultation program. So you go out and give advice for how to, and they come from the fines and penalties.
Any follow-up? Anybody else? Thanks for going into detail and being quick.
Mr. Members, thank you very much for your courtesies.
All right, now we have the Office of Broadband Development for the rest of our time here. We'll see if they're tech savvy as their name. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the invitation to come and talk to you today. My name is Dana McKenzie. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Broadband Development. My understanding is today's goals were just to provide you with a brief review of the office activities with a specific focus on the grant program in order to help you inform your discussions going forward. And so my comments are brief, and I'm happy to answer any specific questions to take a deeper dive as is necessary or desired. Very briefly, I won't spend much time on this slide, but for those who are new to this, to the office and the subject, this slide captures, and you'll have in your packet, just some of the tasks and duties and activities of the office that fall outside of the grant program specifically. The grant program and the associated mapping and data collection are two that are probably the most germane to today's conversation. But our staff spends a lot of time talking with communities, providers, cities, counties, and individuals to help them identify solutions for closing those broadband gaps. And here's a map that you have probably seen before, which is an updated map of the most recent data gathering on this that reflects the state's current statutory broadband goals that were updated last year, and with those being a 2022 goal of reaching all homes and businesses with a service of 25 megabits down by 3 megabits up, and a 2026 goal of reaching all homes and businesses with 100 meg down by 20 meg up. You'll see the pink areas are those areas that are defined as unserved. using those definitions, the lavender areas are those that are the underserved, which means they meet that 25-3 definition, but they don't meet that 100 by 20. And the light blue are those areas that have achieved both of those goals. This next map is, when I've come before, we typically use a heat map to show percentage of households served at goal speed, and we've done it by county in the past. One of the things that was identified as problematic, particularly in counties that had large population centers, is that the information for the remainder of the county was skewed. So we went to a township-level reflection of those percentages, and so that's what you're seeing here, which more accurately represents where there is and isn't service. The other thing to note on this slide is with current estimates of households in and the current definition is we estimate about 209,000 households statewide still do not meet that first 2022 goal. Very briefly, this is just a quick, we don't spend a lot of time on this at this stage of the game because policy is focused on that first goal, but we also do gather data and are measuring where that percentage rates of that next term goal of 100 by 20, and you'll see here that statewide just over 70% of households meet that, and when you look at just rural, we're back down into the 52% range of home households that are teed up for that 2026 goal. And specifically to the grant program, again, this is more just a quick review of what the grant program is. It's the main policy tool that we have in place to assist in addressing that gap of reaching those households that are un- and underserved. It is specifically targeted as an incentive grant to help close the capital gap in those areas of the state where traditional financial models have not prevailed in bringing service into those areas on their own. And so the funding is targeted solely at the capital costs of bringing broadband network components into those areas. Some of the things I get asked about whether or not this grant covers are things like adoption activities, in other words, teaching people the value of Internet so that they would buy Internet. Those pieces are not covered by this program. And another one is telephone and video service that often come along on these networks. This program does not fund those components of the network. And here, probably the thing that I'm asked most about this week is the announcements that were just recently made as far as round three is concerned of the grant program. As you see here, we announced a total of 42 applications were able to be funded with the approximately $34 million available from last year's appropriation into this program. There were 62 applications in total, $55 million in requests. We attracted with those applications over $40 million in public or in private and local matching funds to be paired with the state funds. And then you'll see here we're projecting, based on the applications, roughly 19,000 households and businesses and anchor institutions will be served with those investments. The next couple of lines on that slide, I'm capturing several points that I know have been points of interest and may come up in your policy discussions, is the breakdown between unserved and underserved. You'll see the large majority of those passings in this round will be for unserved, with a relatively small amount going to the underserved. And as a reminder, refresher, there last year it was determined to set aside $5 million as being eligible for underserved applications. We, in fact, only saw about $2.6 million in applications for that category and ended up funding about $1.9 million in applications. And I can take a deeper dive into some of the details on that if you're interested, but at this point I'll keep going. And then the third chunk that is where our questions are coming up policy-wise is the challenge process. The challenge process was as executed as outlined in law. We had 44 challenges were received against 28 of the applications, which came from 13 different entities, 13 different challengers. And so that it was utilized, and the half a dozen of those challenges did result in an otherwise viable project not moving forward because there was a credible claim that service either was already there or is planned to be constructed within the time frame outlined in law. That's not a complete number because there are also situations where the challenge identified small numbers of households or small areas, and there was discussion both with challenger and applicant, and those areas were removed from the grant, and the remainder of the application continued forward. And then just very briefly, this is an aggregate of all 3 years of investment. The map shows that there was good geographic diversity dispersion, both in applications and awards, and you'll see the totals there. The one piece of information that we haven't touched on yet is the bottom number here. 19 of the 31 projects from round 1 and 2 are functionally complete with 95 to 100% of construction. We don't have data and numbers on outcomes yet. That's just starting to come in because those projects are being formally closed out now. But we are seeing those projects progress and complete. I show this one just to warm up the numbers just a little bit. It reminds people of what types of activities this is actually funding. The top slide is a young man up in the northwest part of the state, chest deep in a swamp, making sure that a fiber line gets to where it needs to go. And the bottom one is a photo from one of our site visits that reminds us why Rock County is called Rock County. And then one of the things that it was shared with me that you are interested in was the selection process. It's detailed and has multiple components, and we could spend a lot of time going into this. This slide is dense. I put the detail here to prompt questions if you have them. This is a stack of components that our program deals with from the RFP all the way through the award process, and a number of the milestones within that stack are dictated through the legislation.
We have a couple questions here.
Okay.
Oh. I already stopped it, so.
Oh. Okay, sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I don't know if you're going to announce this as well, but I know that as we wrapped up this year's grants, and again, I followed it pretty close this year, and our county was one of the recipients this year of some very good things, so that was really good. 45% or so of the total dollars spent in the investment this year was state dollars versus about, what, 52 or 53% private, is that right?
I believe it's 50. I don't have the number in front of me. You're in the right ballpark.
Okay.
And I can get the exact figures for you.
Representative.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair, too, as well. You're starting to close out older grants now, which is great, over the first couple of years of this. Have you found any grants that you've approved earlier that have really kind of fell flat on their face, that didn't perform like they wanted to or they should have? Has there been any learning curves from a few of the earlier awardees that haven't showed the follow-through or the fruits that we were looking for? Anything like that, Commissioner?
Chair, Representative. Early on in the first round, we had one award actually decline. They were an out-of-state entity, and I'm not sure they understood the program completely. So by the time we got to the end, they declined. So those funds went back into the pool and have since been awarded in the subsequent rounds. As far as any projects that have not prevailed, we have not seen that. Not even an inkling of that. One of the highlights of the program, or one of the things that helps administer the program, is it's done on a reimbursement basis. So we're very hands-on. Each of the applicants submits invoices each month, and we pay a half or whatever the contractual arrangement is on those. So we have very regular contact, and we identify any issues or problems. And I believe that we are on track to have the vast majority finish within the time period that their contract was allotted. Most of them are finishing early.
Ms. McKenzie, a couple minutes left, so you just finish up.
Absolutely. I don't have a lot more here. Just a little bit, I think, some stories about the grant projects. First of all, because we are just finishing up, we don't have numbers as far as some of the outcomes, but we do have a little bit of the information painting a picture of what these projects mean. And just as an example, we heard from a North Dakota mayor that one of our Minnesota businesses was making inquiring phone calls across the border because their business required robust broadband and it wasn't available in the location they were at. And this manufacturing business ultimately ended up getting the connectivity they needed, and they stayed in Minnesota. And she has provided good testimony to us on how what this meant for her business. Another example of a different sort is I was at an event in New Ulm and was aggressively approached by a father and a daughter because they really wanted to get their story out there that this was a situation where the daughter had some alternative learning needs that couldn't be met in the district. And the fact that they were able to get robust broadband from one of these programs allowed her to stay at home and get those services remotely and not have to travel a great distance to get those. So that's just two examples of the human stories of the types of things these projects are impacting. The list you have in front of you is I would consider on our watch list for interesting to watch into with this third round of funding. And I would just highlight the Sunrise Township partnership with Chisago County and CenturyLink as a good example, interesting example of a community coming together with a provider and reaching out to the program as to be that third leg of the stool and examine ways that federal, private, and state funding can be braided together to achieve additional outcomes that none of the three of those would be able to do on their own. And the added nice thing about that story is all of that project was driven by a manufacturer in that town that needed robust broadband in order to stay where they were at. And so they ended up being the energizer behind that project. And then the others on the list, Candy Ojai and Frontier is also another example of federal funding being braided with state funding and achieving more expedited construction schedule along with more robust outcomes than the federal program alone would be. The Lismore project is on the list because I know there's an interest in, and ourselves included, in continuing to examine how wireless plays a role in this portfolio of investments. Lismore is doing a hybrid fiber and wireless project where they are running fiber to the areas where it makes fiscal sense, and they are connecting through fixed wireless to those more remote areas where that makes sense. They have some longer-term vision of getting wired service out to those, but at least while it fulfills the need, they are using fixed wireless. And we have a number of those around the state, both grant-funded and non-grant-funded. And then finally, I would just highlight Mille Lacs. That is the first Mille Lacs Energy Electric Co-op partnering with the Telephone Co-op to bring service to one of our two least served counties in the state. And so this is a model with electric co-op involvement that we're interested in watching develop. And that's all I have.
We have a couple member questions here. And if you can take your questions offline, that'd be ideal since we're already over. But Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Mahoney, for the original investments in the governor's office for pushing, and Chair Garofalo for maybe reluctantly, I won't go where Representative Baker did, funding some of it. But I do think this program's come a long way. I appreciate Representative Baker being able to work with you and Rep. Kreshaw over the last few years on it. And I think your office has done just a bang-up job. I know it was one of my biggest learning bills. Sometimes you pick some fights and get into stuff that you don't know how long it's going to last. This one's been every year I've been in the legislature, and I did learn a lot from it as it went along. But I think it's really come into something that looks like it's developing, working for communities, working with the local businesses here, and getting that connectivity out to folks. So appreciate all the work, and we can talk offline later.
I just want a copy of the pictures that Baker had on Garofalo.
So we were fighting back and forth. Or did you do that?
No, the black
man. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dana. I don't want to take a lot of time because I know we're over time. But first of all, I just want to give Dana credit. She's been a leader in broadband for, I don't know, 10, 15 years out of Grand Marais. So she's a rural leader and a good person to be leading this effort because she's been there fighting the good fights at the grassroots level. But my question is, and I hope it's a simple question, thank you, first of all, for doing color maps. We're so used to looking at black and white, and it's so hard to discern. But I'm looking at all the dark blue in the tip of the Arrowhead and elsewhere around the state, and I'm just wondering what do these areas have in common that they have achieved such a high level of broadband? Is it all federal funds? What is it?
Ms. McKenzie.
Mr. Chair, Representative. That's a great question. It's no one specific thing. There are some contributing factors to those cluster areas. In the northeast state, both Cook and Lake County, in Cook's case, it was the electric co-op took advantage of our federal stimulus funds and were funded for projects. So both of those counties now should be largely covered. For their future needs. The large cluster over in the more western northern part of the state is really the product of aggressive build out by local co-ops. In particular, Paul Bunyan and Garden Valley are two of the entities that are working in there. And so they took both private and in some cases federal funding and invested in fiber to the home early on in the process. And you'll see something similar over in the central western part of the state with Federated and Farmers Mutual.
Any follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dan.
Anybody want to keep us longer before we adjourn? All right, thank you for your time. We adjourn.
Thank you.